Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for this program. A while ago, we ran a show looking at crime in Las Vegas. And one of the subjects that we touched upon was the role that drugs had played. Unfortunately, we really didn't have time to explore the subject of drugs in any great depth. And so I thought it would be fun to assemble a similar panel of people. Some of you were with us for that first program, and take a look at drugs one more time. As always, our phone lines are open, and the number to call is area code 646-378-1120, or you're welcome to ask your questions or leave your comments in our chat room. Okay, let's introduce the panel. From Las Vegas, we have best-selling author and crime writer Denny Griffin. Denny was an investigator in New York for many years. He now makes Las Vegas his home, and he specializes in books about crime. Denny, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Simon. Glad to be with you and the rest of the panel.
And from Los Angeles, we have Jay Rankin. Jay is also an author. His book, Under the Neon Sky, is an autobiographical work that explores the 6 years that he worked at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas as a night doorman. Drugs of one shape or another are very much a part of this book, and I thought he would be an excellent person to have on the panel. Jay, I am so glad you could make time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Simon. Very excited to be with this panel.
And we also have Andrew DiDonato. Andrew was a member of the New York Gambino family. One of his responsibilities was the establishment of a drug highway reaching from San Diego to New York. He is currently working on a couple of projects. He has a DVD documentary, which I'm sure we will get to at some point during the program. And he is also working with Denny Griffin on a biography, which apparently they're hoping to get out by the end of the year. I'm looking forward to discussing both of those. Another guest we have with us is Vito Colucci. He's a renowned private investigator who's been involved in many high-profile cases. And prior to becoming an investigator, he worked for law enforcement, including a stint as a narcotic detective. He also was involved in undercover organized crime. Vito is also the author of a newly released book, Inside the Private Eyes of a PI. Vito, it is wonderful to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Simon. It is my pleasure to be on your show today. Even though Denny Griffith told me he was booking me today with Simon Cowell from American Idol, so it's a wrong Simon, but I'm still very happy to be here.
Well, I mean, you got to understand, Denny's getting on in years.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, you sound much nicer than the other Simon. Thank you.
our final guest is another author, Armando Aldazabal. Armando has two books in print, Cocaine Memoirs and What You Are Turning Me Into. Although they're novels, they do actually pull very heavily on his own personal experience of friends and family being involved in the drug world. Armando, it is great to have you on the line.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to start with Vito. You were a narcotics detective. It seems to me that the drug trade has changed significantly over the past, let's say, 30 years. The drugs of choice have changed. We seem to have moved away somewhat from things like heroin and acid and moved into the crack and speed and designer drug world. Do you think law enforcement is winning the drug war?
Well, you know, I don't know if you could win here. I think it's more different degrees of losing, okay? You try to do the best you can. I was a narcotics detective for a long time, and your opening statement is right. You know, a lot of the drugs have changed, even though, you know, marijuana is still the most widely used drug. Cocaine, which I worked, is still out there, even though crack is fairly new. Heroin was very, very big during my time of using it. I never used it. What a slip that was. But, you know, working it. But it has been making a comeback. And, you know, you have the new drugs, you have the pills, you have the OxyContin, you have a lot of stuff that's out there now. But I think it's good for your listeners to kind of know. I'll just give one example, and the other experts there can kind of chime in just to let them know. Heroin is a morphine opium derivative, okay? It's twice as potent as morphine. And it can be smoked in tobacco. It could be heated on, let's say, aluminum foil and injected under the skin into either the muscle or the vein part. So I think it's good maybe as we go on as people can give a little description of each drug. But heroin, I've seen many people lying dead on the ground when we arrived at a scene, on bathroom floors mainly, needles still stuck in their arm. But, it's kind of always been there. Sometimes it's kind of like not referred to too much, but heroin is still out there.
I agree. If, you know, there was an instance a few years back, I had these friends of mine who happened to be in the heroin business, and they would actually put the first batch that they would put into the street, they would put in pure heroin, and knowing what the repercussions of that would be, they would know that people would overdose from it. But what happened is there was such a market and such a competition between drug dealers that they figured that if the people would die for it, the other drug abusers were always wanted to go to the place where they figured they were going to get the most pure stuff. And believe it or not, those two or three people, and it's not nice to speak about, whose lives were lost by injecting pure heroin into their skin, ultimately was like a marketing tool for these guys to make the big money.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, Andrew.
Yeah, Armando, you've been around the drug business quite a long time. Have you had any dealings with people on heroin?
Not too much heroin. Growing up in Miami, it was mostly cocaine. And when I started living in Orlando, Florida, it was a huge crack epidemic. Where I grew up, there was crack houses everywhere, people on the corner, because people with the bowels all over the floor, the pipes all over the streets. Not so much with heroin, but not too long ago, I had a friend of mine actually overdose and pass away from a mixture of opiates and benzos. So he was actually snorting Xanax mixed with Roxy's, and too much of that ended his life. And my thing has always been and will always be the lack of education on drugs that's out there today. And that to me, like Vito said, there is no win, but that could make the biggest difference to me.
Jay, Los Angeles has a relatively bad reputation for drugs. What's your take on the heroin situation?
Oh, gosh, I don't know where to begin with this panel, because I think we all relate to what each of us are saying. I know my experience personally has mostly dealt with, from my generation, certainly heroin was around, and all of the treatments for heroin was around in those days, and everything seemed to evolve. It just got worse and worse going through the 60s, 70s, 80s. Everything went from, it was almost like music, you know. There's a new band in town. It was the same thing with drugs, where all of a sudden people, you know, went to cocaine and then crack and then the pills. And now today I'm seeing, other than a lot of meth and crack, of course, I don't know what's going to resolve that. But even in my day in Las Vegas, I mean, the stuff on the streets was crazy. There was a place where a lot of the employees went, and it was actually a pub. And pubs in Las Vegas are, you know, they're like bars, and they got slot machines. And in every slot machine on a bar, there was, you know, like an area where the coins would come out. And you go in there and you put your $20 in, and the bartender, instead of giving you a drink, you know, he'd give you a little baggie, and usually it was cocaine. But there's so many drugs out there today. It's so complex. It's and the mixture. I see heroin coming back a lot as well. But people are starting to mix stuff now, and it's to me out of hand. It's you know, I'm interviewed a lot, and everybody says, well, what's the secret to surviving a weekend in Las Vegas? And you know, I keep saying moderation. I mean, people are going to drink 24/7, and they're going to do drugs. And I don't know what the answer is anymore. I really don't. It's just a part of life these days, and there's tons of money to be made from this stuff. And the police, you know, are I think up to their chins with work on this stuff. There just doesn't seem to be any answers anymore.
Denny, I'm going to ask you a slightly different question. It was mentioned that, you know, heroin is making a comeback. It is an opiate. And it seems to me that the most common treatment for opiate addiction is methadone. Are we just trading one addiction for another with methadone?
I think that's possible, Simon, but, you know, I've been kind of chomping to get in here after listening to Vito and comment on his take that it's not so much winning the war, it's the degree of losing. And I've had that opinion for quite some time that the war on drugs, our war on drugs, is... I don't really see an end here as far as a clear-cut victory. I see maybe delaying things, but I just, it's so entrenched, I think, that I really don't see a way out of it with a clear-cut victory. I think Armando is 100% right. Education certainly is a step in the right direction. My concern is that we aren't going to be able to educate enough people quickly enough to do the job, and that because we've talked on other shows about the side effects of the drug trade, we've talked a lot about that with the children issue and child abuse, and these kind of things scare the hell out of me. And like I say, my concern is that there's no clear-cut victory in sight, and are we going to be able to do enough quickly enough in the education area and other areas to really make a difference? I hope we can. I'm just not that confident.
Okay, education, that is an important point. Armando, you have 5 children. And Armando's a very busy boy, I'd like to point out. What are you doing to ensure that you educate your children to stay away from drugs?
First of all, I'm very honest with my children. I'm very honest with my children when it comes to everything. I put it out there for them. I let them know the dangers behind it, I show them pictures of the addicts. I drive them by these neighborhoods where they can visually see where they would end up if they were to abuse these substances. I homeschool all my children. All my children are in my full custody. And I have other family members, like my little nephew. He's right now in middle school, and for the last 2 years, that middle school hasn't had one police officer go and speak at the school. They haven't had one celebrity, someone that these kids can look up to and say, "Wow, he's not doing the drugs. Maybe I don't have to do it to become like him."
Someone has their computer speakers turned up. Can you please turn the volume down? We're getting an echo. I'm sorry, Armando. Carry on.
All right. So, if we start educating these kids right away, elementary, middle school, I like to say high school, but that's become pretty much the new drug spots, the new drug houses of today. So, if we get them right away, maybe we can win the war on drugs in the near future. In the future, as far as the present,
Can I say something too, Simon?
Certainly, Jay.
Because I'd like to respond to Andrew and to Armando. You know, my take on all of this, and certainly what Denny said too about education, is I come from a whole different place. I feel extremely discouraged. I think that drugs have been around in this country forever, and I put them in the same category as alcohol. And I just think that there's something about the human brain that has a need for escape, that has a need to feel good. I'm not sure why or how or what that's all about. I think there's a million reality shows out there right now and you can even watch Cops, and there's shows on rehab houses and Intervention, the series on Intervention, which is a very sad show to watch. The camera just points to a family who's devastated, and they're literally watching a son, daughter, dad, mom die right in front of them, and they're trying to get them with some intervention. It shows people binging. There's Rehab House. There's so many shows on, and I don't think it's making a dent. I agree that the high schools, you know, are the big thing right now, but it seems to have crossed all cultures. It's crossed all financial. I don't care if it's Beverly Hills or you know, Southside, Detroit, Watts. It doesn't matter. I've got a stepdaughter who has lost 7 high school friends, all to drugs, and that's a lot for one kid to lose by age 16 or 17. And I see it with adults, too, and I saw it all through Las Vegas. I mean, business is booming, and people can't get enough prescription pills. They can't get enough opiates. They can't get enough cocaine. And I personally don't understand the methamphetamine thing. It's pure poison. It degenerates body parts within weeks. I know people that did it for 1 week and about 4, 5, 6 weeks later, they had 8, 9 cavities. That's how quickly that drug ravages the body. You educate, you try to tell the kids what it does to your organs, what it's doing to your heart, you know, and everything just begins to shut down. They keep doing it. I don't know what the answer is. I have no clue. I'm not sure education has anything to do with it. I got a 7-year-old boy, and my greatest fear is that when he hits high school or whenever, and it's laid out in front of him, which it will be at some point in time, that split-second decision of a kid whose brain isn't even fully developed, and it happens to be in the area of survival instincts, that split-second moment in time, all he needs to do is one hit, one line, drop one pill, and it could be over after all my love, all my caring, all of my hopes and dreams for this little boy. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm very discouraged.
I think on the whole picture, as far as like the financial side of it, I don't think that wherever there's a means to make money, I don't think that the government will ever really truly be able to stop it. like Vito said, they could just, you know, keep trying and they keep, you know, be persistent in their actions to try to, you know, take as many major drug distributors off the street to work, you know, on the street corner guys, do what they can do within their areas. But what people are missing is there's so much prescription medications today that are accessible to kids, don't even have to leave the house to get high. And it's a sick thing, because if you look on the television, there's a pill for this, there's a pill for that, there's a pill for this. You know, a kid could go into his medicines cabinet, he can get depression medication, he can get Oxycontin, he can get a whole bunch of stuff right in his medicine cabinet. And it's just too accessible for kids. And like Armando said before, if you educate them, you may be able to cut out that aspect of it. But there's too much money overall being made that to prevent it to keep on. Because whenever there's money to be made, you could take a guy, you could cut his head off. It's like Medusa. You cut the head off, another head will grow, and somebody else will be there to try to make that dollar. So there is no happy ending with this. There's not. You know, like he just talked about his children. It's like you could instill the greatest, greatest things in your kids. You could raise them right. You could put them in the proper schools. You could educate them. You could show them love. But like he said, a lot of it turns out to be luck. You have to be lucky that your children don't want to go down that road, or their character is strong enough not to succumb to that peer pressure. And as a parent, hey, I'm a parent. Everybody here on the panel knows that it is a scary thought. And it could turn out to be an innocent thing. And then next thing you know, your kid has some sort of habit, and you got to watch them deteriorate, and it's heartbreaking.
I read an article, or I had a conversation with someone not very long ago, and it was about the new in thing for kids. You go raid your parents' medicine cabinet, you all get together, you throw the pills in a bowl, and everyone grabs a handful at random. Now, doesn't that sound like a recipe for success?
They've actually got a name for that.
Yeah, they
really?
Do.
I can't, it doesn't come to mind right now, but when we did one of our shows, Simon, actually a lady called in, if you remember, and she was explaining that, and that's insanity right there.
Yeah, that's horrible.
And that's where the education comes in, because if they're educated
right.
to some extent about the effects of certain drugs, maybe they won't. But if these guys are going to go randomly and just pick a pill, they don't know what it does, what the side effect is, nothing. Like you said, these kids could just die right there on the spot. It's just heartbreaking.
And just to touch on what Andrew said about the whole money situation, I know drug dealers that haven't touched a drug in their lives, and they're in it strictly to make money. Strictly. So
well,
how do you win when like you said, you know, you cut the head off and it grows right back, and then you have the addict that keeps, you know, I mean, there's...
Plus, you know, if you look at it like I mentioned before, it's crossing all ages. It's crossing, you know, all cultures. There's a town in Oregon. The population's not that big, but it's, I guess, the most per capita polluted with drugs town in America, and these are doctors, these are lawyers, and it's because there's a several meth labs, and it's all methamphetamine, because it's such a highly addicting drug, you try it once or twice. And interestingly, I've got a friend that's an ex-cop from Vegas, and I was telling him how I know this guy that's 55 years old, and for the first time in his life, he's addicted to methamphetamine. And his first question was did he have a new girlfriend that was addicted? And sure enough, he did. And he said, well, that's how most middle-aged guys or even senior citizens get involved with drugs. I mean, it's just amazing what this drug thing is doing. And, you know, I think one of the reasons meth, because we were talking about money, is so popular is because it's so cheap. It's really cheap. If you have your choice between that and cocaine, meth is a lot cheaper than coke. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Simon?
Yes.
Can I chime in on what the last person just said?
Oh, certainly.
It's very true. You know, with meth, It's inexpensive, you know, and it's one of the most powerful addictive stimulants that is out there, okay, because it really hits your central nervous system.
Right.
And it's made so easily. It's made with, you know, inexpensive, some of the stuff over-the-counter ingredients. Not so much anymore over-the-counter. I mean, I have to stand in line now at a pharmacy and fill out a form to get my Claritin D for my hay fever, you see. Mm. So that's what's going on in our pharmacies now. So many things now you have to stand in line. It's, you know, and meth has such a high potential, you know, for widespread abuse, and it's incredible going on. But, you know, there's so much, see, different from the years that I worked at. You look at what's going on in Mexico right now, where, you know, you put on the news and they say last week in Mexico, 300 drug dealers killed each other. And it's just incredible because there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that are flowing. If somebody's working, let's say a border guard or has some access to Arizona or something from Mexico, you know, those people will go and hand you $50,000 to say, just turn your head, here's $50,000, go buy your wife a brand new car type of a thing. So there's so much money, politicians, cops, everything. It's amazing now. There was a lot of money when I worked it, but the amounts now are so astronomical that that's what's keeping it flowing. And they're all killing each other now, too. You know, and it's a shame, but it's a lot of stuff going on out there, so it's all coming into the country.
Just to touch on the whole Mexican issue, I was also reading on that, and to me, that is one of the consequences. That is what happens when you begin to decriminalize drugs, all sorts of drugs. Everybody starts to want a piece of the pie, and then you got to start, you know, drawing out the ones that are making the most, and you can become the one that's making the most, and I think that's why drugs, you know, here in America at least, will not be ever like legal, or you know, it's not going to be legal for you to carry crack around or anything like that, you know.
Hey, Andrew, we talked on a previous show, and basically everyone was in agreement that the whole drug business was, in fact, a lot safer under the rule of the mob. I mean, it may sound crazy, but it is actually true. I mean, I look at what's happening along the Mexican border at the moment, these small border towns, and they've become war zones.
Well, the reason for that, Simon, is the reason they became war zones is because they're letting you know, without putting a dollar amount on it, how much money is at risk here. These guys are fighting, killing each other, because the money to make is so great that it's worth them to go that extra step to try to make sure that they can control what happens in that area. And that's the sad part of it. The sad part of it is that when it comes to the amount of money these guys are making, getting the drugs over the border, your life is worth nothing to them compared to what they could make. So, you know, there's no quality of life there. You know, you're expendable. You're expendable. You're in my way of making hundreds of million dollars, like Vito said, coming in. You know, it's a no-brainer for these guys to kill you, you know, and that's where people need to see. For these guys to go out on the street and hundreds of people to die in just a weekend, that tells you the extent of the greed that these guys are trying to control this market. And as far as organized crime, making it safer, the only thing that I can say about organized crime, I agree with that aspect about organized crime, but the thing with us was, when we had a certain, you have to understand something, no guys in organized crime, if you follow the quote-unquote rules, are supposed to be upfront in their drug dealing. So what they do is, they don't want anybody to upset the apple cart, so to speak. So that's why it's controlled. They don't want no violence for no particular reason. You make sure that if you got a system working, let it work. Keep everybody happy. Nobody steals. Nobody gets out of line, because it's all about the dollar and cents. Now, of course, there'd be violence in certain issues, but only if it need be. You know, and on that aspect of it, I agree. But today, these guys are, there's just too much out there. These guys are, it's just ridiculous. And these are the things you're hearing about. How about the things you don't hear about?
Oh, indeed. Vito, I'm sure you would like to weigh in on this subject.
Yeah, I mean, and I was thinking as Andrew was talking, I was thinking about my time as a narcotics cop, and I can remember specifically two or three times when the most powerful of powerful drug dealers would talk to me and my partner privately and tell us how much money they wanted to give us on a regular basis to just let them be, leave them alone, don't arrest them. Give them a call if we heard the feds were in town or something of that nature. And we never did it. But I can see what happens with people because, like Denny and Andrew know, I went undercover wearing a wire with the FBI to investigate my own bosses who couldn't resist that, my own sergeant, my own lieutenant that ran the whole drug and gambling trade and the whole not just in one big city but in the whole county. So that's what happens. It starts out, you know, now I could assure you my lieutenant did not get on the police department to do bad things. Everything I've heard from the people that knew him knew he was an honorable cop, and he did a good job for many years, okay? But then what happens when somebody says, man, here's $10,000, and you think what you could do with it, and then once you take it the first time, that's it. You're done with, you know, and that's what happened with these guys, and that's what's still going on now. It's an astronomical amount of money, and it's a shame, and it's something you have to fight as an honest politician, an honest lawman, you know, mayors, whatever it may be, because, you know, they're bottling up all these people now.
Denny, you've been very quiet, and I know you listen, you ruminate, and then you come out with powerful thoughts.
Yes, I think Andrew just mentioned how much stuff is we don't hear about that we don't know about. And that brings me to something we've talked about on other programs, is we talk violations of the law regarding the drug business. But how much crime can be attributed to drugs, different types of burglaries, robberies, those types of things that would be drug-related. And I'm wondering, when you take the actual drug violations and add on the other laws that are violated as a result of the drug business, what kind of percentage are we looking at of total crime that we could say is a direct a result or side effect of the drug business? Anybody have an idea?
When I was away, Dennis, you know, I was incarcerated for many years. And when I was away, I could truly tell you that the guys that had drug-related crimes, it would just, I can't begin to tell you how many drug-related crimes are in prison. And that's why the prisons, with the overcrowding, they started to implement programs for the guys that were just in who were users or stuff like that. As long as they didn't have violence, they would put these guys in these drug programs to alleviate the system a little bit because there were so many of them. But I've seen people throw their lives away for their addictions. I mean, I've seen some solid guys over the years who's like Armando said something before, they were in the drug game, they never touched drugs in their life, and then one day, boom, they did. And they became one of their biggest, they were the biggest suppliers, and they became one of the biggest users. And it turned their lives around. And I've seen it so many times. Well, guys, what are you in for? Oh, like I had a burglary. I was in the house. I was high. I murdered the people in the house. I was high. I mean,
they don't even know.
that's the guys that they go under. You know, I was desperate. I was fiending. I didn't know what was happening. And they go as far as that, but it just goes to show that crime would never have been committed, like Dennis said, had these people not had that addiction or that need or that want. That person whose life was taken for no other reason but so this guy could get some money in his pocket to go and get that feeling.
Okay, I want to go back to this Mexican border issue. I mean, clearly the product is making it across the border. I mean, that's obvious. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing all of this violence going on. Do we need to do something to tighten up the you know, import-export?
Well, Simon, that's a good point. The only problem is our country nowadays doesn't even have enough money to keep the public libraries open a certain amount of hours, yet alone try to put honest, untouchable-type people guarding our borders. There's just, unfortunately, not enough money and not enough accountability and everything else that goes along with that. It's a very good point, and we should. And, you know, these border guards and other people do get arrested continuously. But that's the whole darn problem. By the time they get arrested, you know, so many kilos and other things have already come into our country. But it's a good point. And Denny hit a great point as far as what people do in our country to obtain enough money to buy all of these products, the burglaries, the larcenies. People are murdered. The murder rate goes up in bigger cities. And that stuff is all going on. As a private detective now for 21 years, I get calls all the time from mothers and fathers whose sons and daughters are living in the house. And, you know, they are robbing from them and doing, you know, whatever they have to do to sell statuettes and very valuable stuff that is in these homes to get enough just to buy a couple bags, you know?
Jay, you must have some thoughts on the whole border issue.
You know, if it's okay with you, Simon, can I make a left turn here for a second?
Of course.
Because I would love to respond to some of the things that I've been listening to with Andrew and Armando and Denny. And once again, you know, I guess I'm so discouraged, but all that being said, here's my left turn. Imagine a world without drugs. Now, if there were no drugs, and I'm really and truly playing the devil's advocate here, but it seems to me that if you were to build a business prospectus on drugs, on your product and putting it out there to the world, you've got your suppliers, you've got your inventory, you've got your distributors, and you've got plenty of customers. And this is a prime, perfect business perspective. And if you think about how many people are employed because of drugs, if you think about all the cops, the detectives, even the gun trade business, if you think about the prison business, if you think about the lawyers, the PIs, all the doctors and nurses, the rehabs, you're talking about tens of thousands of people that are employed because of drugs. And if you want to take being the devil's advocate, you want to further, you're talking about the payoffs. And it's not just payoffs for cops, it's or politicians, it's payoffs to the government, to the country. You've got lobbyists. I personally don't see what the difference is between a pharmaceutical company that's pushing oxys and the heroin trade. I don't really see a big difference. I really and truly don't, to the letter of the word. The lobbyists go straight to Washington. They're spending millions of dollars a week to keep these things legal, even though people are dying like flies. So if you look at it in terms of a business perspective, and I know that I'm going to kind of shut this group up for a second, but without drugs, I think we'd be screwed in some ways. I really do. Even the gangs, if you look at the gangs, if you look at the employment of high school kids on the corners, if you look at prostitution, and some of these people are customers, and it just seems to me that getting back to the first thing that I think it was Armando, possibly, or Andrew, and Denny talked about, education. I mean, I don't think this conversation has changed since, I don't know when, since the days of smoking dope, of people taking acid and mushrooms, of people doing lines of cocaine. Nothing's changed except for one thing. Gangs have become much more mobile, and there's a hell of a lot more guns. And the people of poor countries have found that they can get a job. They can be paid. and they can feed themselves and feed their families. And it's all because of drugs.
Well, not only drugs, I mean crime itself. If you know that any big city that has crime in it, that keeps the economy, like you said, and it keeps people, there's money, there's money out there for people to get accessible to. And the drug game feeds into that. As far as the Border Patrol and the borders itself, you have to understand, if you have a Border Patrol guy, just saying, hypothetically, who is on the take, so to speak, they give him, Vito mentioned something before about you give this guy $50,000, $100,000, whatever. What they do to this guy is they say, listen, we're going to send a load through. It's a decoy load. You're going to pinch that load. You take it. You get the credit for it. You do your job. And as that load is getting pinched, they got more going through at the same time. And they'll give up a load to get another load in. You know,
well, Andrew, here's my question to you, Andrew and Danny and Vito and Armando. Where would our lives be today if it weren't for drugs? Where would we be, guys?
Actually, you bring up a very salient point. The title of the book escapes me, but I read it probably a year ago, and it was, I want to say it was something like the 21st Century Economy. And it was a very, you know, well-reasoned book, and the subject of drugs came up. In fact, the author made quite a big deal out of it, and that if you were to remove the illegal drug trade, it would cripple the economy in so many different ways.
So my thing is, can we possibly have a positive conversation on drugs? I don't know where the hell I'm going, guys, and I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. All I know is that drugs have affected each of us so profoundly that I tend to wonder where our lives would be right now, where my life would be, where the world would be, where the employment rate would be. It's an ugly, ugly, big view of this because a lot of people die every day from it. I agree. And we're all scared because we've now got kids, and we don't want our kids to do what we did, and we've seen a lot, and it's just a horrible path. I agree. But as
so then the ironic part would be is that people who are not only addicted to it physically, now you've got people who have nothing to do with taking drugs or using drugs, but they also need those drugs as well. So it's like an ironic part. It's like,
yeah.
All right, you're the abuser and you need the drugs physically. Well, not me personally, but people who are out there now, well, I need the drugs to keep coming in because it's going to put money in my pocket one way or another. If you're a border guard or if you're this or that, and I'm not trying to take away from the border guard's job. I mean, I'm sure that's a hard job, especially they must be low manned or whatever they're doing over there. I'm just giving hypotheticals here, but it's kind of weird when you think about it is everybody doesn't want it to affect their lives. Everybody tries to do everything they could do to, you know, school their children, to, you know, keep it as far away from their loved ones as possible because it's a dirty, dirty thing. But there's so many people out there dependent upon it for financial gain that it'll never end. This discussion could go on for years. As long as there's money to be made, there'll always be a drug dealer. As long as there's money to be made, there'll always be somebody to help a drug dealer. And there'll always be somebody who's looking with their hand out because, let's face it, there's no money out there anymore.
And I think that we all need to admit to ourselves, Andrew, you certainly, where would you be financially? What would you be doing if drugs were not a part of your life? Armando, how many books would you sell if you couldn't write anything about coke? Vito, what would you have been doing instead? Denny, what would you be writing about? All of us, we're so affected by this. It's profound. It really is. Stunning.
Okay, I had a question for you. This is Armando. Actually, to touch on what you were saying previously, you're based in L.A., correct?
Yes.
Well, you know, from what I mean, I lived in California for 5 months not too long ago, and from what I gathered the economy there is pretty much like 85% based on marijuana. What do you think about the whole dispensary and the whole legalization over there?
Oh, it's going to happen. There's no doubt about it, and it's way overdue. Way overdue. I mean, L.A. is so full of these places that are selling prescription marijuana. I even know people in Utah that are growing it for the government, and it's just you know what? It really is legal already in a lot of ways. It really is. I think sometimes the police and the government officials put up a good front, saying, "Listen, folks, you're paying taxes. This is what you're paying us for. Here's the statistics." And if you look at the border guards, you know, it's become laughable at this point. Marijuana, they're trying to stop these, you know, tons of this coming across the border, and yet the United States government is paying farmers to grow it. It's all political. It's all about lobbyists. There's thousands of doctors that are writing prescriptions for it. I don't know what the statistics are for California, but I know that you can go to Oakland, you can go to, I think it's Van Nuys, and there's storefronts, and they're selling cookies, and they're selling this, and they're selling that. It's all got marijuana in it.
They actually
and all you need
plant.
To do is walk in with a piece of paper, prescription, and to me it's laughable. So it's up for a vote again to make it legal, and this time they say it's got a good chance to pass. It'll have limitations, but marijuana is going to be passed. And when it does, I'm not so sure that the huge money and kickbacks are going to flow like they used to. It scares me almost. I wonder what's going to take its place. It reminds me of Vegas. It reminds me of Las Vegas is in a recession. And what that means is that they're not getting the money that they used to get. The players aren't there, so that revenue has gone way down. They've had to lower their room rates and food rates, so that revenue has gone way down. But what's gone up has been alcohol. This is what Vegas pushes big time. They want their cocktail girls to speed walk. They don't want a customer with an empty drink sitting there. There's a show called Rehab about the Hard Rock, and it's about a pool nightclub, and it caters and targets to college kids. And if you watch that show, it's insane. These cocktail girls get bonuses for selling magnums of vodka. And this is what Vegas has stooped down to. I mean, they've got to show a revenue because it's a Wall Street town these days. And so there's going to be... There's going to be one vice or another one that's going to be pushed, whether it's legal or illegal. And also, before we end this, I don't know how long we're doing this, Simon, I also wanted to ask Andrew about the different gangs, the different mafias, too, at some point as it deals with drugs, whether it's if he knows much about the Russian or Chinese.
Please go ahead.
Yeah,
what's your question?
Well, when we were talking, Andrew, about, and I think Simon brought it up, about the Italian mafia, my experience in Las Vegas was more with the Russian and Chinese. And since I've been out of Vegas, it seems what's growing by leaps and bounds all over the country is Mexican. So, you know, my feeling about this is how did these things evolve to the point where there's literally armies and armies? I remember the Bloods, you know, or the Crips would go to different towns and they would draft young kids. Like one of the L.A., I think it was Crips, you know, started, they'd get kicked out of L.A. and they'd move to Vegas, in North Vegas. And they started opening up little chapters of gangs, much like a motorcycle gang. But these the MS gangs in from Mexico, the Salvadorian gang, you know, these guys, it's insane. And it's all drug-related, the whole thing. This is how they get their income for the most part. But I personally dealt with the Chinese mafia in Vegas. So I'm not sure how they took over.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I'll explain to you how these things work. You see, what happened was the United States government targeted the traditional organized crime members first and foremost. because in the government's eyes, the organized crime members in the United States were the biggest threat to the government. Because what happens is, I'm in my neighborhood. I can infiltrate a legitimate business. I can fit in. I can mix in anywhere. The only thing I can't do is that I have an accent so everybody knows I'm from New York. But not everybody from New York is in the mafia. So I can mix in that way. So when these other ethnic groups started to fill the void of all the Italian-American men who've been locked up due to organized crime activity, it left that gap to be taken over by other gang groups who are not going to control it the same way, who didn't grow up with the same disciplines or select quote-unquote rules to follow. Because although these rules are not written down on a piece of paper anywhere, we were supposed to follow a certain amount of rules. You know, you don't go and hurt law enforcement people. You don't do other certain things. You keep your business clean. Of course, there's going to be violence. There's violence in every sort of drug trade. But you try to control it to the point where you keep everything on the down low because you don't want to mess up the apple cart. These other criminal organizations have a little bit more different effect on how to discipline problems. If you're a problem to them, instead of trying to get you in line and make you march like a Marine and make you do the things you need to do, they're just going to kill you. They're just going to kill you. They're going to kill you outright. They're going to kill you in a brutal way because they're figuring that's going to send the best message possible. And like I said, it filled the void. There's not as many organized crime members in the United States who are out and about the way it used to be. I could truly honestly say that. As it shows now, you've got five families just in the New York area. If a guy comes up to be boss of that family, within you could put this guy's picture on a wall. Within a year of him being the boss, or even less, he's in jail. They lock this guy up. They have no tolerance for that anymore. So now these different families are being run by panels. So law enforcement can't target one particular boss anymore. So you got three or four guys running their day-to-day aspects of the family to try to survive. It's getting so bad now that they're breaking down organized crime, traditional organized crime, down to almost like gang activity now, where instead of having hundreds and hundreds of members, you've got guys who've been stealing the street with each other. They're not even going to trust guys within their own family anymore. If I was still in the street, in that life, I could tell you right now that I would only do things with the guys that I've been around my whole life. I wouldn't talk to a guy. I couldn't care if he was a boss, lieutenant, colonel, whatever you want to call this guy. I would never give him any solid information about what I was doing. Those days are long gone. And it's because of the constant barrage of the government going after traditional organized crime first. Then they work their ways to these other organized crime families like the Japanese, the Russians, and that's what filled the void, Jay, and that's what it was. And now these guys, they run their show differently. They do. They run their show 100% differently. And that's the difference that I see. That's the difference. That we were first on the target list. The American gangster, or I should say organized crime member, was the first target. The other organizations were just afterwards. And that's not right now. I deal with a place called C-16, C-17 in New York. They're FBI agents. And they deal with a lot of, you know, different ethnic background organized crime guys now because they got everything else in New York under control.
Denny, you've been remarkably quiet.
Yes. I'd like to get back to Jay's point for a minute about the economy.
I have to say first, Denny, that Andrew made me very sad with that last thing. It used to be so organized.
I know.
What a sad commentary on the drug trade. Jesus. Go ahead, Denny. I'm sorry.
The economic aspect of the drug trade and how many people, legitimate jobs, the police officers, the doctors, the nurses, the lawyers, the PIs, and so forth, how much business they get as a result of the drug business. And, you know, that there are people employed then making a living on the drugs, both legally and illegally. And it's an industry, both sides of it, whether it be the pharmaceutical companies, which are, whether we support them or not, they're legit, they're businesses, recognized businesses, and then the illegal drug activity. And that's very true, and it's something that I have thought about in the past, but I don't think about it as often as I should, and I'm glad Jay brought that up. It is an important thing, a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And I think you can take that to other areas of crime also. Let's say I just did a little research on Paulie Castellano, who was the former boss of the Gambinos. And he was a legitimate businessman in the sense he had a lot or several legitimate businesses regarding the meat business. And now how much of the money, the capital that he invested into these legitimate businesses came from organized crime activities, I don't know. But I'm sure some of it, some of the money he made from illegal activities ended up going into legitimate activities that hire legitimate working people who are not involved in crime. And I'm sure the money, people who are involved in the prostitution thing, some of the money they get, they probably use to open legitimate businesses and so on. So I think you can almost look at the drugs we're talking about, and certainly that's a major, major, major thing. But I think you can look at a lot of different criminal activities and almost make that same comparison, that all of them at some point are economic factors in this country. I think to a great degree the economy, and even though we're in a downturn at the moment, but the economy relies a lot on crime to one degree or another.
Deep and philosophical as always, Denny. I'll tell you what, we're going to take an absolutely shameless commercial break, because I do want to recognize the panel and their expertise. And I'm going to start this short commercial break with one of the a funny story that happened to me yesterday on the way to the gas station. I like to stroll in the mornings. You know, the fresh air is good for you. And it's only about a 10 or an 8 block walk. Well, two blocks from my home, there's a house, and I know the gentleman that owns it. He's redoing it for his daughter. And I stop and chat with John fairly regularly. And sure enough, John was there yesterday, so having a little chat, and the mail lady stopped. And it turns out the mail lady is John's daughter, which I really didn't know. And she recognized me because of the huge number of packages she delivers. And she said, "Oh, are you going to be home in 10 minutes? And I said, "Oh, no, probably not. I've got to go up to the gas station." She said, "Oh, I've got an express package for you. Do you want it now?" So, you know, she goes rummaging around in her truck and gives me the package. I looked at it and I said, "I know exactly what this is." And she went, you know, didn't bat an eyelid. And I said, "It's from one of my ex-mobster friends." at which point she climbed in her truck and drove off. it was actually from Andrew. And Andrew, you have a new DVD coming out. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, the name of the DVD is Surviving the Mob. It's basically accounted from, it's supposed to be like stories from my life within organized crime. And we started out to do this project after me and Denny started with the book. We thought it might be something nice to have a DVD and a book. So it was turned out to be a very emotional ride for me, which I didn't think it would be. But, you know, tapping into those old things that ultimately I tapped into things that altered my life, you know, and altered people around me's lives in so many different ways. So what started out is just, okay, let's get some things on film. So we want to help people. What I'm trying to do now is I'm not trying to glamorize organized crime in any way, shape, or form. I'm trying to show people the true, brutal reality and be so brutally honest to let them see that these guys who are in these positions, it's not like the Sopranos on TV. You know, at the end of the day, people bleed real blood. Families' lives are ruined. You know, there's no celebrities here. There's guys here that just, it's a greedy, selfish, one-way street. And there are no happy endings. And that's what I tried to portray in this documentary. And I think the guys from Two Wheel Productions did a wonderful job with it. And it's going to help us with our book, because those people who don't like to read books, because there are people out there who don't, will enjoy the DVD because they will still get to see a side of that life that's really not exposed the way it should be on television. Go ahead.
There was one little piece. I watched the DVD yesterday, I know it's not for sale yet, it's still in, you know, pre-production, if you will. But you tell this story about being in a car pulling up next to some sort of delivery truck or something, and just opening up with the guns, and you go, I am so glad I didn't actually kill the guy.
See, because what happens is back then you think you're a part of something special. You think that what you're doing, you're justified in your actions. You're feeling as though that the guys that you're around are, this is your family. This is what you think. This is what you're indoctrinated to believe. And then as you get older and you start to see how you lose friends, how people are dying around you, and how you see how you're going to prison and friends you're never going to see again, and you start to see for what it really is, and you start to see that you given this life, and at the end, when you're done giving, and the powers to be think that there's no more to take from you, they take your life. That's what happens. And I say thank God that that person that I shot somebody on that day, and I'm not proud of it. I was involved in a lot of violence in my life. And on that particular incident that you're speaking about, I am glad that person lived. Because these are the things that affect me now, and the message I'm trying to get out now to get kids that are growing up who think it's cool to be in gangs, who will watch TV and think that, you know, being that gangster is so great. Let me tell you something. It's a brutal, brutal life. And it ruins everything around you. And that life, so what people need to understand something, is that everything it touches, it destroys. Everything. There's maybe 1% of the guys in this life, from its inception, 1% who could actually say that they lived their lives, robbed their money, and could spend time with their grandchildren and see their children dance and dance at their children's weddings. These guys are rotten in prisons. These other guys, like me, I became a government witness. And you look for a happy medium. There is none. There is none. Because, all right, I'm alive, and I appreciate that. And I know I'm lucky to be alive. Okay?
When does the DVD actually come out?
May 1st. May 1st. It'll be available for the public. And those guys really did a wonderful job with it. Two Real Productions, I became really close with them on the partaking of it. And they did a great job. That's all I could say. The first one we did, it was a question and answers type thing, and then we changed the whole format. It went to just like a storytelling, and they really hit a home run with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's fabulous. Can't wait to see the final edit. Presumably it'll be available on Amazon and those kinds of places.
Yeah, well, it'll be, it could go, you can get it on the tworeelproduction.com website. You can get it on the survivingthemob.com website. I'll send out memos, and Jay, I promise you I'll send you one as soon as it comes out.
Oh, don't mess with me. I'm telling you, Andrew, I'm looking forward to this. Don't do me
Vito
wrong,
knows
my
already.
Friend.
He's got, Vito already knows he's got one. I don't even have to tell Vito. He knows he's a shoo-in for one.
I'm so looking forward to it, man. I really am. I can't wait.
Okay.
And I really appreciate
I'm actually
you
proud of you, Andrew. I really am, man. I think that you came from a world and it is your responsibility now to share your life with people. I think that you're doing such a great thing. I really do. I think that you and Denny are just right on path, man. And I can't wait to read this.
Dennis took me a long way, actually. Dennis took me a long way. I mean, when we started the project, he told me, he says, listen, first and foremost on this project, we want to show true honesty. We don't want to glamorize anything. And I said, listen, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So the marriage was a good marriage as far as getting the book out there. You know, so I got my fingers crossed that, you know, it gets out there earlier than later. But they say early fall, but on e-books and I think on the Kindle, it'll be out over the summertime.
And I'll be looking,
looking forward to it.
Yeah. Denny, time to give you a plug. You've got, what, 500,000 books in print?
Well, not quite. I'm working toward that goal. Now, I've got 10 out, and Surviving the Mob, Andrew's bio, will be the 11th.
Right, and your last book was a biography of Frank Collado, was it not?
Yes, it was. And, you know, it's funny, Simon, how things work, and you don't necessarily have these things in mind when you're doing them. But, you know, going back to, I was on the verge of quitting writing back in the early 2000s because I was doing fiction and I was kind of spinning my wheels, I thought. And I went to a writer's conference and the lady I met there said I should switch to true crime. And the one true crime book was a police history of Las Vegas Metro. Got me interested in the Tony Spilotro era, which led to the battle for Las Vegas. Through that, I met Frank Collado, which led me to Collado. And because of Collado, when Andrew was looking for someone to work with on his book, I used the term made my bones, you know, the mafia term. But because I had worked with another former mobster, Frank Collado, that caused Andrew to contact me about working with him on his book. So it's funny the way these things work out.
Oh, it certainly is. I can honestly say I have read The Battle for Las Vegas and Collado, and they are fabulous reads. If you are interested in, you know, true crime, Denny Griffin is your man. Denny, what is your website for people that want to rush out and order gazillions of copies?
www.DennisNGriffin.com. DennisNGriffin.com.
Okay. Vito, I understand you have recently released a book. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's called Inside the Private Eyes of a PI. And basically what it is, a couple of people that have written stories about it have called it the most comprehensive book out there on what it's like to be a private detective. And it's a little bit of everything. It's me talking about the high-profile cases that have worked across the country, the Michael Skakel case, Jason Williams, the NBA basketball star. I just finished working the chimpanzee case for the lady that was victimized by the chimp. And then it has chapters on, you know, divorce, has chapters on missing persons, background checks, surveillance, personal injury, on and on and on. And I've been very excited about it. It has done very well. People can get it on my website, which is Colucci, P-I, which is Colucci.com, or on Amazon. And it's Inside the Private Eyes of a PI. And down the road, I'll have a second book out, which will be talk about me and my undercover days wearing a wire and infiltrating two mob families and just everything that went on during that whole period. So thank you.
I want to know why I haven't read it yet.
It's an excellent book. I read it. Excellent. It's an excellent book.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'm going to have to track down a copy. Do you need a review done, Vito?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I could definitely email me your address. I'll get one out to you, and that would be super.
You bet. I'll be happy to do that.
Okay.
Jay, tell us about your book and where people can get it.
Well, I wrote a story about my days working from 7 at night to 3 a.m. at the MGM Grand as the doorman, and all that I saw and experienced, and it kind of, the story Under the Neon Sky takes you, from my perspective, I kind of put you on a front row seat of what I saw through my eyes in the middle of the night in Las Vegas for 6 years, and all that I went through. There was a murder of a good friend of mine, certainly the gambling and the drugs of my coworkers, and how the town affected me and my own marriage. And the title again is Under the Neon Sky, a Las Vegas doorman story. And you can get it at any Barnes & Noble or on Amazon, or you can go to my website, which is jayslasvegas.com. And you can download the first chapter, which drops you in the middle of the night that Mike Tyson bit off a piece of Holyfield's ear, and the absolute riot that occurred that night. And it was insane. They had to shut the hotel down. A lot of arrests, a lot of people hurt, SWAT. It was quite the night. You can read that chapter for free if you go to jayslasvegas.com. And again, the title is Under the Neon Sky by Jay Rankin.
I really enjoyed Under the Neon Sky. In fact, as a result of reading the book, Jay and I have kind of become friends. I mean, and anyone that wants to see a little bit about the seamier side of Las Vegas, read this book. In fact, it should be on your reading list if you're planning on visiting. And Armando, you have two books. Tell us about them, where people can get them.
Yes, the first book is entitled What You're Turning Me Into. It's basically the story of redemption, someone trying to make ends with their past. Actually, the book became one huge apology to my mother. You can find that book anywhere on Amazon. You can find it at whatyoureturningmeinto.com. The second book is Cocaine Memoirs, which I kind of took a different approach to it versus trying to be completely 100% factual. I try to just kind of like take a twist to it and just add a few more things to it or whatnot, kind of hide a million truths with a million lies. And the book is basically a twisted love story about someone trying to come to terms with the cocaine overdose death of his father and the fact that he left that habit to him as well, and just pretty much his battle with this addiction and trying to make the best of his life. And that book actually became a huge apology to my father. And you can find that at cocainememoirsanovel.com, and that'll take you through a million different websites where you can actually purchase the book.
Okay, all right.
That's, and I like to quickly thank my Europeans for purchasing the book.
Right. In fact, you've found that sales are going gangbusters, and particularly in Europe.
Yeah, actually, the European crowd, maybe they're thinking outside the box and actually getting the message behind the book. I tend to write as a one-person format, so the reader actually is the addict, and I don't know.
Well, all I can say is both books are well worth reading. Okay, back to our scheduled programming. 30 years ago, no one had ever heard of abusing prescription drugs or the term doctor shopping. Now it seems to be as prevalent and lucrative as the street drug business. In fact, I read an article a couple of weeks ago. Law enforcement busted 5 pain clinics in Florida, and the version I read claims that these five pain clinics had prescribed more than 2 million oxys and roxys. What's wrong with this picture? Armando, this is your neck of the woods.
Yes.
What the hell was going on?
I can't begin to describe what is going on. This has always been a prevalent state for prescription medicine and pills. I mean, back then there was a huge epidemic with the whole ecstasy and Rufinols. Here, pretty much, like I said, the schools have become the pain clinics. You can go to school and get anything from Vicodins to Percocets, Lortab, Xanax, Propofol. I mean, you can get whatever you need here in Florida. I mean, you can go to a hospital with just a knee pain, and they're going to prescribe you, 30 Percocets. My thing, like I have to go back to it, is the education. As far as doctor shopping, an addict is going to do what the addict is going to have to do to get what he needs. And the doctor, he's going by the fact that the person needs help, and that's his job, is to help that person. It's not his responsibility that person wants to take more than he prescribed them and kill himself with it. So I think that the doctors are not completely to be blamed here. Yeah, you got your bad apples, but they're not fully responsible for this whole thing that's going here in Florida. Like I said, an addict is going to do what an addict is going to do. And here, pretty much, pain clinics have become the dispensaries in California.
Vito, as an ex-law enforcement person and obviously a man of high moral fiber, how do we fix this problem?
Well, one thing to add to what Armando said that goes on, and I've worked many cases of this nature, and I've also talked about hundreds of them on worldwide television, is the rich people do not have the same rules as the middle-class people in obtaining their prescriptions, okay? And what I mean by that is basically I've seen many, many cases where wound up with deaths of people where the individual had been able to obtain numerous prescriptions, both from their regular doctor in town and the doctor calling or communicating with, let's say, Fort Worth, Texas, or some other place of that nature, and getting numerous other pills, same pills for that individual, which allowed that person to have did one not too long ago where the person had 500-600 of the same pills when they should have had maybe 30 or 40. And they have different rules. You're seeing that now a lot with when you deal with the celebrities, the Michael Jackson, everybody else that's in the news nowadays. And it's horrible what goes on out there. So I think your listeners need to understand that there's two sets of rules with that. One that led to the death of one of my clients was the girl who was the daughter of a very big Hollywood producer, was able to go to a party with hundreds of pills, whereas she was supposed to maybe have 30 or 40 in her vial, and was able to give them out, and which led at the end of the night to the death of one man. And that's what goes on. You're seeing that in all the cases. I'm trying to think of the who's the actress that just died a couple years ago. I probably did 150 shows on her. It's the blonde, the buxom blonde that married the old guy. I can't even remember her name.
Yeah.
Nicole Simpson.
No.
I can't believe it. I've talked about it on so many.
Anna Nicole Smith.
Same type of situation. I mean, people are shocked by it. It goes back to Elvis Presley. It goes to Michael Jackson. It goes to Anna Nicole Smith. See, they don't have the same rules. Their doctor and doctors will give them as many of that one or two or five medications, hundreds of pills on that. And I see it all the time in my business. I live in an area which is the second richest county in the entire country. And there's celebrities, there's all the sports figures that live here in the Greenwich, Connecticut area. I mean, it's all through the county. And it goes on all the time. I see it. I'm not surprised anymore because I've seen it so many times. So I think that's a good point coming off of Armando's thing that the listeners need to understand.
Okay. I think we're in agreement that, you know, drugs as a whole are a bad thing. Earlier in the show, someone mentioned, in fact, I think it was Jay, the high likelihood that marijuana would become legalized in California. In fact, in some ways it already is. While it's not legal, I believe that if you're caught, you know, with less than an ounce or something, they effectively write you the equivalent of a parking ticket. If marijuana was legalized, what are the implications? Does it necessarily lead to people taking stronger things? I don't know who wants to field that question. Armando, let's pick you.
I actually think so. I mean, it's a huge contradiction to what we've taught our kids and we've heard all our lives how marijuana is this gateway drug to other stronger drugs. So by legalizing it, you're right. I mean, what are we saying? What are we saying to, say, our children that, you know, their parents are legally smoking pot and they have to go to school smelling like it, you know what I mean? Or, you know, in North Carolina, you can grow up to 98 plants. I mean, I'm sure. So I definitely think that it's a huge contradiction in our government because they've led us to believe this thing. It's almost like saying, oh, the Bible's not true or something. Or, you know, it's just going back again, you know. And to me, California's only motivation for this is money.
Denny.
Yes.
What's your feelings about marijuana leading to stronger drugs?
Well, my suspicion is that there probably would. I'm certainly not saying in every case, but I think the potential is there. Simon, something just come up. I'm going to have to run. I want to thank you for having me on today and thank the rest of the panel, and it was a pleasure. And before the show ends, I was remiss in one thing. Maybe it could be mentioned before you sign off that Andrew and Vito and I are involved in the CrimeWire project, and maybe one of them could just take a second before the show shuts down and tell your listeners what that's about. Okay, thanks, and everybody have a great day.
Denny, good talking to you again.
Pleasure as always, Dennis.
Okay, Jay, should marijuana be legalized?
I don't think it's going to matter. I think that it will come with so many restrictions that it'll still be very illegal. It'll still be coming across the border. You know, there's going to be the vast majority of people that will not have prescriptions to use it that are going to use it. So the illegalities will still be in place. It'll still be a huge revenue source for writing, you know, the tickets and stuff like that. It's just, you know, and the point being made about, you know, how it's a contradiction, and it is. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, so is alcohol, so is cigarettes. The kids go to school, and they've watched, and they know the smell of alcohol in their parents' breath every morning before they leave for school. And their clothes, you know, sometimes I'll smell a child whose hair or clothes smell like cigarettes and you know, it is what it is. It's just I don't believe it's going to make that big of a change. I think that everything will still more or less be in place, depending on how the new laws are written.
That will limit the population in prison somewhat.
Yeah. Vito, do you think you know, decriminalizing marijuana would be a good or bad thing?
I don't think it would be a good thing, Simon, if I could touch on 2 points. I mean,
sure.
As the next cop, maybe the only one on the panel that can say this, is that, you know, I've arrested people for marijuana and then a year later arrested them for pills, let's say a year later for cocaine, and then a year later for heroin. So I've seen that over and over again, not in all cases, but in many, many cases where it led to harder drugs. And then I've had to go tell the mother and father that their son is dead after finding the guy in the backyard someplace, like I said before, with a needle in his arm. But see, there's an illustration. The same knife that you use to cut your bread, you can kill your neighbor. Okay? Now, what I'm saying with that is that, you know, marijuana has been used lately. It helps cancer patients. Okay? It treats the nausea that they get sometimes after they have some kinds of chemotherapy, okay? It helps AIDS patients. So, you know, there is good that comes out of it. But, you know, the people that want to legalize is, hey, man, I want to legalize. I don't want nobody to bother me anymore. I don't want the people to tell me I can't do my pot. And, you know, just like the guys that I've arrested and do cases on now that watch porn online and get addicted to porn, they start out with something maybe not so hardcore, and that does not fulfill them. And they keep going farther and farther. Then they're into kiddie porn. They're into this. They're into that. And it's a known fact. And again, so your listeners understand, that's not in every single case. But I've seen it. The vast majority, it leads to bigger things. The gambler that starts out with 50 cents and everything, maybe he could stay at 50 cents on a slot machine. But many, many of them, that thrill is gone, and they have to continue to go farther and farther with it. And I do not think that would be a good thing.
Andrew, what's your
yes.
your take on it? Do you think they should legalize marijuana?
I tell you the truth, I agree with Vito. I think that it opens the gates for bigger and better things to come. I mean, I've witnessed it. I've seen guys, if something's available to you every day, and it's there for you, and after a while you do this every day, and after a while you don't get the same effect you used to get. So what happens is they try something else to go back to that original feeling that they got. So they will go to other drugs. Like I think Jay said it correctly. He said they're going to legalize it. But I think we need to see how the laws are going to be written as to see if it's really going to affect the overall criminal aspects of it, where guys are still going to be selling it for major profits or anything of that nature. But it does escalate. It does take – marijuana was supposed to be the not-so-bad effect drug of all, but it opens the doors to other drugs being available to you, you know. So I don't know if it will be legalized or not. And if it is, the government will control it.
Right.
If it's legalized, you can bet that the government will control it, because like anything else that has to do with money, the government will make sure that they run it, and this way they'll get the majority of the money from it. And now a guy like me, if I was still in the street, I wouldn't go to something that's legalized, because now you have to pay taxes on the money. You have to do all these other things. If I was in the street, now that would turn me to look to my business for a different kind of drug.
Oh, of course, and that makes perfect economic sense. You know, who wants to pay taxes? I know.
That's what these guys are in the business for, so you don't have to declare these dollars. So now you're going to have to declare these dollars. And if you got the clientele, that's one thing. But if you're some other guy who just, you know, now you'll go to either cocaine, heroin, whatever's out there, whatever's going to be the next drug that's available to you to sell, that's where you'll go. You know, it'll change the forecast of everything, I should say. But Vito hit it right on the head. It definitely opens the floodgates.
Okay, Vito,
yes.
Denny had to leave. Give us a quick update on what you guys are up to.
Okay, CrimeWire, me, Andrew, Denny, the fellows from Two Real Productions, and Susan Murphy Milano, who's probably one of the premier victims advocates in the country, have come up with CrimeWire. We've just did a pilot for a new TV show that I've been discussing with A&E. And basically what it is, it's cases where the family, let's say, of the victim, usually in a death, the cases are unsolved. Maybe they feel the police have not done all they can do. They'd like to get the cases reopened. They'd like to have maybe a show like Nancy Grace feature it. They want to keep it fresh and out there in the public, and that's where we come in. We try to review the case. We try to do whatever we can for them if we believe in it. And like I said, we did a pilot episode in Vegas on the death of a kid called Jason Turner, who died a few years ago, whose grandfather used to own the Dunes Hotel and was also an attorney for Jimmy Hoffa back then. And it's an interesting case, but that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give people an avenue through our website, through the TV show, where they can discuss the case on the CrimeWire site. Once that is fully up in about the next 2 weeks, they can join the site, they can discuss cases, they can give their opinions, just kind of like what is done on a blog talk show, where people can blog and talk about whatever's going on that show at that time. So we're excited about it. It's been a fun project, and that's how I got to meet all these guys.
And do you have a website up and running?
Yes, it's called the CrimeWire site. It's up. It is. They can get an idea of it. They'll see pictures of some of us. They'll see a homepage. They'll see a description of what we're going to be doing. And I think people can get an idea on that. And we ask them to, make any comments they can. And like I said, it'll be fully up and running with all of the things downloaded probably within two more weeks. So we're very excited about that. And we're just trying to do what we can for the you see a case on Nancy Grace, but that's one of thousands of cases that are going on across our country that people feel hopeless and lost. Where am I going to turn to now? My case is 1 year old. People don't understand with police departments, things happen. Right away you see 50 guys that are working the case. People don't realize after a short time that's reduced to 20, that's reduced to 10, that's reduced to 5, and then pretty soon there's one detective that's just handling leads that as they come in. So that's kind of what happens with a lot of the cases, the murder cases, the unsolved cases, and there needs to be an avenue for people to keep these cases fresh, and I think that's where we come in.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. I have seen the pilot, and I'm very impressed.
Well, thank you.
Okay, we're completely out of time. I do want to thank our wonderful panel of experts, and I spell experts with a capital E. I mean, these guys know their stuff. We lost Denny a few minutes ago, but I do want to thank Denny Griffin for taking time to talk with us. Jay Rankin is with us. Jay, thank you so much for spending your day talking to the likes of us.
Vito, Armando, Andrew, really a pleasure, you guys. Really was. Andrew, really good talking to you again. And
you
Simon,
too, Jay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Andrew DiDonato, it is always, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Simon.
There's an advert on the TV for a Mexican beer. I think it's called Dos Equis or something like that. And it features this rather well-dressed older gentleman with a gray beard. And he's known as the most interesting man in the world. But I think you might have him beat.
Yeah, you know why? You're being too kind, my friend. But all I can say is it was a pleasure. You guys, it was really, really interesting to meet every one of you. Vito, I'll speak to you real soon, my friend. Yeah. Tell everybody in your family says hi. All right?
Yep.
Simon, whenever you want to speak again, you'd be more than happy. I'll speak to you anytime you'd like, my friend.
Oh, you bet. And we will be talking again. And that brings us on to Vito Colucci. Vito, I think this is the first time we've spoken.
Yes,
it has been delightful.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you very much for having me on your show. You run an excellent show.
And I am sure that the whole bunch of us will be getting together again in the not-too-distant future. I mean, It's not often that you can bring together such a diverse group of people.
Thank you, Simon.
And that brings us on to Armando. Armando, thank you. I mean, I always enjoy talking with you. I love your books, and you always have great, great input.
Well, thank you, Simon. It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. And I also want to say pleasure to Vito, Andrew, Jay.
Thank you, guys.
If you guys would like the book, get in touch with Simon to give me some information, and I'll be more than happy
Absolutely.
To send you guys a talk.
Thank you very much, Armando. Thank you.
In fact, what I'll do is I'll email Denny and get him to basically get everyone's email addresses, et cetera. All right, and we can all keep in touch. So this is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a great Saturday and stay drug-free. Goodbye.